Hello, everyone, and welcome to the first of what we hope will be many FRCS podcasts. I'm Harry Rattan, urologist at Nottingham. First things first, I will let my fabulous co-host introduce herself. Good evening, Sophia.
Evening, Harry. My name's Sophia Cashman. I'm an ST7 in the east of England. And I met Harry working on the Viva course, doing the BP lecture. And I think this will be a really great series, hopefully, for trainees. I know that when I was revising, I found it that I had a lot of time in the car, for example, commuting, as a lot of us do. And I found it frustrating that I couldn't, when I was trying to cram everything in, use that time. So hopefully podcasts and having things easily available will really help.
Yeah, I mean, we're going to be your new kind of drive time buddies, I guess, aren't we, Sophia?
Easy to mute.
Yeah, very easy to mute. So the series is obviously primarily aimed at those of you who are preparing for the FRCS exam, particularly the Viva component, but we're hoping it'll also be of interest and use to those of us who did the exam a little while ago, maybe, and have forgotten everything. So
I'm not going to comment on that one.
So anyway, we'll crack on with the proper academic stuff. So to start us off in our series, we thought we'd focus on a really common topic, which of course is the 60-something-year-old chap with bothersome low urinary tract symptoms. And as we're all aware, there's a huge range of stuff out there, Sophia, isn't there? And it can be a bit of a maze to
Absolutely.
Navigate.
Yeah, and there seems to be a new technology or new technique at least every few months. And some of them have stuck around and seem to be really taking hold, and some of them have clearly fallen by the wayside.
Exactly. But the thing is that patients are much more well-informed, aren't they, now, and they've often read about these things. Our case, then, is your typical 66-year-old man with bothersome LUTS. So he's predominantly complaining of poor flow, some post-mic dribbling, which is a bit embarrassing, and he's also experienced some frequency and urgency, and he gets up two or three times most nights to void. In terms of his general health, he has a history of hypertension, and he's on ramipril and amlodipine for that. His GP did put him on alpha blockers a couple of years ago, and these were certainly beneficial for a little while, but he now finds things getting worse again. The alpha blockers seem ineffectual. He did try finasteride, which his GP put him on, but he really couldn't continue those due to the sexual side effects. He's had a flow rate measured in clinic with a Qmax of about 9 mils per second and a post-void residual volume of 150 mils. His IPSS score is 25 with a quality of life score of 5. Amazingly, he had his prostate ultrasounded and it measures around 60 cc's.
So, is very convenient that he's had that done, isn't it?
Very convenient. Never happens in Nottingham. What are you going to do with him then?
So I suppose the first thing is to pick out some key things that has been mentioned. He's already tried medical therapy, so there's no point reinventing the wheel with that one. And he also sounds like he's reasonably fit. You know, he's on minimal medications. He's not that old. So he clearly is a surgical candidate and wouldn't be an option for everything. And the last thing is his flow rate sounds like an outflow obstruction, and he's bothered. So he clearly does want treatment, because poor flow rate doesn't equal treatment in a happy patient with no red flags. But assuming that this man has come in, as you said, to discuss it, in reality and backed up by the guidelines, he really should have all options discussed with him. Mm. So relevant guidelines, I suppose, would be the NICE guidelines in the UK. And that kind of says only use transurethral incision under 30, only offer open prostatectomies. Not seen that for a very long time, over 80.
No, even I haven't seen that for
even
very many
you.
Years,
wow.
Being of a considerable vintage. So those two options are obviously out.
But the rest of them are available. And similar for the EAU guidelines, that kind of 30 to 80 middle range prostate has pretty much everything available. So I suppose we should talk through all of them.
He has obviously come in having read about all the latest and greatest stuff, but I think it's really important to talk about good old-fashioned TURP here, isn't it?
It is, and based on HES data and based on the bowel snapshot audit, he is statistically likely to get a TURP. And, you know, that's not necessarily anything wrong with that. TURP, as we know, relies on monopolar diathermy, so We use glycine, and it's a very well-established long follow-up procedure, which has very good outcomes.
So are you telling me that you'd still preferentially use monopolar? I mean, what do you think of bipolar?
Well, I personally would prefer bipolar for multiple reasons. The NICE tech approval in January of last year looked at Turis versus monopolar, and they have equivalent effectiveness, but obviously it eliminates TUR syndrome, which does still happen. And I know we talk about it as if it's something that doesn't happen anymore, but it does. It also reduces bleeding, length of stay, and it works out as a bit cheaper with equivalent side effects. So really, I think most people are moving to the bipolar systems. However, I wonder in the modern era if the new player that is here to stay, which I think is the first proper challenge to the TURP, is the HOLEP. And obviously one of the benefits is most people already have a holmium laser. So it uses the pulse laser, it's absorbed by water and water-containing tissues. And when it's been looked at, it does have a longer operative time, although you do wonder if some of that's a learning curve. But it reduces blood loss, length of stay, and it increases the amount of tissue resected. And I mean, when you look at them, it's a huge amount of tissue that comes out.
And the channel at the end just looks absolutely anatomically perfect, doesn't it, compared to resection. I think there have been a few meta-analyses, haven't there? And I think pretty much all of them would suggest that HOLEP is equivalent in terms of establishing good post-op voiding, good flow rates, improving the IPSS. But I think the niche that HOLEP has kind of found itself at the moment in the UK is probably for the larger prostate, isn't it?
Yeah, and I mean, people are resecting huge prostates up to, you know, 300-400 grams. And these are people that previously, I suppose, would have been told they weren't a surgical option and there was nothing available to them, and this is now something that is there, but it is still available for the kind of middle range prostates.
So our chap for the 60 cc prostate, you'd still be happy to offer him a
absolutely
HOLEP.
Yeah, I think the worry is in the very small ones, and we also, although not relevant to this man, have to remember that HOLEPs are very, very good for acute retention and getting people catheter free. The ARHO data from I think 2021 was a 98.5% catheter-free rate, which is just astounding, isn't it?
Oh, incredible. I mean, there's some talk of being able to do HOLEPs, I think certainly from the Peter Gilling papers, that you can do them on patients who are on active anticoagulation. I mean, that makes me a bit nervous. I mean, you work with Tev Aho at the moment. I mean, does he operate on...
So he will certainly So we do stop them at the moment, but he will start anticoag that night, and leave the catheter in just for, you know, 5 to 7 days, which is great. The one that was badged as the one that's suitable for anticoagulated patients, I suppose, is the green light.
Oh yes.
It's not something I've seen, but I know that some centres use it and really do like it. And I mean, the pictures of it look pretty amazing, don't they? Like this green theatre. And that
very dangerous green light, though, isn't it? It's one of these lasers that you absolutely definitely need to keep your laser specs.
Yeah, exactly.
Sorry, I'm just doing my laser geek bit there. Yeah. Sorry.
Yeah. Segueing into the tech station there, yeah. but yeah, they've got the big goggles on. And downside is you have no tissue for histology, but you can use it in anticoagulated, and it does completely vaporize the tissue. The key paper for green light, comparing it to TURP, was the Goliath study.
Oh, yeah.
And that had 2-year follow-up, and it was non-inferior in terms of IPSS, QMAX, and complications. So it's good. But I think, and I may be wrong, but I'm fairly certain that study did exclude a number of things, such as those in retention and those that were anticoagulated, although it can be used in those that are anticoagulated.
And was it also excluding bigger prostates?
It was, yeah. But I think HOLEP seems to have found its niche in the big prostates.
TURP, HOLEP, green light, I mean, these are all technologies that perhaps have been around for a little bit longer. But as you mentioned in the introduction, there's been an explosion of newer so-called minimally invasive surgical treatment or MIST options for BPH. And there are a number of those, aren't there, all of which have received a lot of airtime in the press as well as in the urology literature. So tell us a bit about UroLift first, Sophia.
Yeah, so UroLift is probably one of the longer existing of the kind of newer mists. the minimally invasive surgical techniques. And these are basically, they're a permanent kind of transprostatic tissue retractor using nitinol and stainless steel clips. You think of it like an absorbable, a non-absorbable stitch almost with ligger clips on the end. When it started, it was for lateral lobes, but it's now regularly being used on middle lobes as well. And you can put in multiple devices, so you can use more than the kind of the picture you see of two on each side. You can use more as needed. The LIFT study, comparing it with a sham, it showed, and that was using prostates between 30 and 80 grams, a good improvement in the IPSS, quality of life, and Qmax. And the important thing, and that was up to 5 years follow-up, but the important thing is there was no de novo erectile dysfunction or ejaculatory dysfunction, which is really important, and especially for the younger men who really do, and some of the older ones, who really do not want to risk their sexual function. Again, I think the Pulsar study was using it in retention with a lot of success, and there was the BPH6 looking at it versus TURP. And it did say, you know, IPSS and Qmax was better in the TURP arm, but the UroLift preserved erectile and ejaculatory function, which is very important.
I mean, this is, after all, an operation which aims to improve quality of life, doesn't it? And
yeah, absolutely.
I guess we can agree that the flow rate isn't, you know, equivalent to quality of life for these men.
Yeah, and it's, you know, this doesn't need to be a kind of end point for them. This is a brilliant option for people who want something doing, but maybe aren't willing to risk the more, you know, thorough, I suppose, resections or enucleations. But they're both still an option for them later down the line. It doesn't preclude it.
What do we think the durability of a UroLift is in terms of, say, 5 years? Is it still effective?
Well, it does seem to be durable, yeah. And the original LIFT study was out to 5 years. And, you know, we see people that have had it in longer than that now. It may not be forever, but it seems for a group of people to be very effective.
There's all this talk about assessing the anatomy of the prostate before you go banging your UroLift device in. Is it used now for men with middle lobe enlargement as well as lateral lobe?
It is. And there are some people that put in a lot of UroLifts and have a lot of experience of doing it. And it basically, they just pull the median load over to one side and pin it down. And so, a prominent middle lobe does not preclude you having a UroLift as we kind of originally thought it might do.
So that's good to know. So certainly worth considering for our chap. And the other thing that, you know, there's been a lot of publicity about is the new Resume treatment.
Yeah.
So what can you tell us about that?
Yeah, so the Resume is, again, a day case procedure, which effectively uses steam to cause kind of cellular necrosis using thermal energy. And again, it seems like a really great option for a kind of less invasive procedure. They all need a catheter, and it does sound like it's a challenging week or two afterwards because, you know, a lot of this tissue will slough off. However, after that, they have good outcomes. There's the McVary study, 5-year follow-up, sham-controlled study, and it did have durable, good improvements in the IPSS and flow rate. They did have a reasonable amount of side effects, most of it initially, and there was some, I believe, ejaculatory dysfunction, but it was very minimal.
Maybe a bit more than with UroLift, but certainly much less than TURP.
Exactly. So I think it sits in that kind of middle ground between the two of them. It's nice approved for moderate to severe LUTS and a 30 to 80 gram prostate. I think they said it was cost saving against TURP and HOLET, but it was uncertain against UroLift. It makes sense in my mind that a bigger prostate maybe would have more complications and need more injections, but it's certainly a good option. And I think it's something that I've anecdotally heard of being performed a lot more frequently now.
And I mean, you mentioned side effects. Are we talking kind of initial discomfort and dysuria and possibly some kind of storage symptoms as
well? Exactly. And I think it sounds like the initial kind of period after it is a bit challenging. What it will be interesting is the PREMIS study that's going to look at UroLift Resume versus TURP in an RCT. The other treatment they are comparing against in that study is the ITIND, which is something I've never seen used.
No, me neither. Tell us about that, because it does sound intriguing, doesn't it?
Yeah, so from what I understand, it's an implantable nitinol expanding basket that goes in and remains in place for 5 to 7 days and then is removed. And the whole premise of it is that it works on prostate remodeling, and it preserves their sexual and ejaculatory function. There was an RCT versus the sham, and it did improve the IPSS at 3 months, but it was not significant against the sham, which was a catheter going in and out. But it's still up to 12 months, did seem to be durable. You know, people's IPSS score was improved, their quality of life score was improved. So, regardless of the initial kind of no significant improvements against a sham, people a year later are happier with their symptoms. So, maybe there is something in it. And the PREMIS study will be really good. I think that's still recruiting at the moment. Good at looking at that compared with some of the more reasonable comparators, which would be a Resium and a UroLift.
So this PREMIS study, is it a UK-based study or is it an international thing?
I believe it is UK. It's so yeah, as we said, it's an RCT of iTind, Resium, UroLift, and TURP. And the primary outcome, I believe, is non-inferiority of IPSS at 12 months, and with secondary outcomes out to about 3 years. Yeah, I think it'll be really interesting because having a good kind of robust against all the mists together would be really good to see.
I guess we ought to mention a couple of other contenders here. Now, I work in Nottingham, which, as you know, is a big vascular radiology, interventional radiology center, and the radiologists are desperate to get their hands on more stuff, aren't they? PAE is certainly something that's gained some popularity. In my mind, I often think of it as something to offer older chaps with really big vascular bleedy prostates who perhaps may not be fit for surgery. Probably a bit unfair, isn't it? Would it be something that we could think about offering our young chap with a 60 cc prostate?
Well, I think again, really, we should be offering everyone all options that are, you know, are options reasonably for them. So PAE obviously uses particle embolization, with resulting light infarction and cell death, and then a volume reduction. NICE say it needs to be done in a unit that has two urologists and two interventional radiologists involved. There's a caveat, I think, in NICE saying formal urodynamics should be performed, but it's
Yes,
up to the
I
unit,
yeah.
whether or not this is invasive. So-called non-invasive urodynamics.
Not quite sure about that one.
No. There was the ROPE study that was an observational study, propensity matched against TURP, and it was found to be non-inferior for quality of life and IPSS. But I think most of the absolutes were better in the TURP arm. But you're right, as you said, it avoids an anaesthetic. Some of them do have sedation. You can do it in the day case. You can carry on with any BPH surgery later down the line if needed. But I think they do have to stay still lying down for quite a long time. And obviously, it will come with its own kind of intervention-related sequelae, such as problems with the access site and risks of bleeding.
Yeah, and I mean, one thing that I've learned from our vascular guys, we've sent a few patients along, is that they do like a CT angiogram. They always like a CT angiogram, don't they, of the pelvis, and quite often, particularly in the older patients with significant atherosclerosis, access to the very fine vessels going to the prostate is difficult, and that precludes PAE because they can't embolize too widely, because then of course you get the worry about embolizing other pelvic
Yeah,
organ blood
absolutely.
supplies. So I'm not sure.
The Bowes Bladder Outflow Day, there was a very good lecture on PAE, which talked about there's a 1% rate of non-targeted embolization causing problem, which would be things like rectal ischemia, penile ulcers, and bladder dysfunction. But I think, I mean, the interventional radiologists are fantastic at selecting out correctly and making sure they've got the right candidate and the right anatomy. But that is definitely a risk that needs to be considered. You know, it's not just this is a non-surgical option for you. It comes with its own risks.
Sure. So, the same principles of counselling, whether it's by a combination of the urologist and the vascular interventionalist, I think is really important, isn't
Exactly.
it? And then the final thing, sorry, Sophia, which I don't think we've mentioned, is Aquablation, which I must admit I've never seen live. I've seen videos of it, and I mean it's meant to be able to ablate large volumes of prostates pretty quickly, but just relies on high pressure jets of water. Is that correct?
Yeah, so from exactly the same as you, I've seen videos of it. And I mean, it looks quite interesting, doesn't it? It's this kind of computer synced system that uses a combined endoscopic and truss view. There's an automated robot, and the treatment duration's independent of the size. They identify the landmarks, the software calculates, and then it's this heat-free cavitating procedure. I think the standard is 2 sweeps of this, and then you do then use the resectoscope and for hemostasis, mainly I understand around the bladder neck. There was the water and the water two trials, I believe. Then there was open water. I think they're the three, all going on the water theme.
Yeah. And not very original, that, is it?
Exactly. Which did show they had significant symptomatic relief, and that it was safe and efficacious. There's a low transfusion rate. I think there's a Canadian study, or the Canadian Journal of Urology published a study of 2,000 patients, and the transfusion rate was low. It was about 0.8%. So it's an option. It's not one I've seen. I don't have the best understanding of it other than, you know, the video scene. And I suppose it is, in cash-strapped NHS, it's convincing a trust to buy the kit more than anything else, I'm sure.
I don't think there are huge numbers of trusts offering it at the moment anyway.
No.
Certainly not compared to Eurolift and Resume and PAE, etc.
No, but from what I understand, those that are doing it are doing good volumes. So
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah,
so it must have a purpose.
Look, we've covered a lot of ground there with all those technologies, and putting ourselves in the patient's shoes, it can be quite confusing to navigate all that, even with a supremely knowledgeable expert like your good self, Sophia. So, I mean, how do we help the patient to make a decision? Because this chap, to be fair, I mean, as we've said, apart from the TUIP and the open prostatectomy, I mean, he could pretty much have anything we've talked about. So how do we best advise him?
Yeah, so this is where the GERFT, the bladder outflow pathway, comes in. And it really focuses on a patient-centered approach and, you know, showing that we should have a portfolio of treatments accessible to all patients through an area network if we don't have it locally. So just the fact that we don't have a green light laser machine doesn't mean the patient shouldn't be offered it. But the key is PDAs, the patient decision aids. And I've seen some really excellent ones from lots of different trusts, you know, some using various different documents or setups, but a lot using a grid and just going through the pros and cons of each option available to the patient and then really helping them. And it is difficult when the patient says, well, what would you have, doc? Obviously not to me, but they do, some just want an answer because it's a lot of information. But I think it really is our role to simplify that so that it is still their choice and we're not pushing, you know, our preference onto them, because they might, for whatever reasons, have quite specific reasons why they would want one of the other treatment options. And it might be that there's something that's a really great option for them and their individual circumstances that they hadn't got on the Daily Mail document that they bring in with them.
No,
so our job as clinicians is to make sure they've got all the information available.
I mean, do you think we should be providing like the majority of the treatments, or is it all about linking together with neighbouring units and building a robust network?
Yeah, I absolutely think it's about linking in with your local trusts, because, you know, we all have that person in our trust that does a large amount of one procedure and is excellent about it. I think it's really important that patients have access to those people, whether or not they're in your trust. So I think it's better than having, you know, a range of kit gathering dust that's used once a year. We should be cross-referring between trusts and between, you know, or between size in trusts to those that have got the skills to do an operation very well. And I think it's, in the current, you know, climate, I don't think it's reasonable to expect people to be experts in all of the, you know, however many we've discussed today, 8 or 9 outflow procedures. But it certainly is reasonable to expect us to be able to provide some way of the patient accessing it.
Yeah, I think that's very reasonable. So as a jobbing endourologist that occasionally sees patients with BPH, I mean, what I've really learned today is that just offering them a TURP is probably very outdated now. And, you know, we really should all be aware of the alternatives available and a little bit about the evidence for each of them, but mainly really to put the ball back in the patient's court as long as they have the information support that they need to make a decision. Is that a fair summary of our discussion?
I think that was an excellent summary, Harry. Thank you.
Oh, you're far too kind, Sophia. Well, I guess that about wraps it up for our first episode. So do listen out for more episodes coming up soon. But until then, that's it from me. And thank you so much, Sophia.
Thank you. Night-night.